joined now by Chris Johnston of Sportsnet and Hockey Night in Canada on the line. CJ, thanks for being with us. What's the latest on the Vancouver Hub City situation? Because it did seem like things were going down the road where it was going to be Vancouver and it was going to be Vegas, but that isn't necessarily the case just yet, it seems.
Yeah, the momentum is completely stopped. And, you know, I think we should all understand how fluid all these situations are, because if we did this hit even 24 hours ago, I would have been speaking about the very likelihood in my estimation that the league was going to, you know, choose Vancouver as one of the hub cities. You know, it doesn't appear that that's the case now, but, you know, again, I think the caveat's important because, you know, there's a lot of back and forth right now with the city still in contention and the NHL. You know, aspects of bids are being tweaked or rearranged, or issues that have come up are being addressed. And so, you know, I don't have full clarity into whether that's a possibility right now, if there's something that can, you know, reverse course here. But it did look like Vancouver was all but certain to become one of the hub cities. And now that appears to be in serious jeopardy.
Do you have a feel for what some of the issues that might be causing this snag could be? We've heard in the past from the provincial health officer here in BC, Bonnie Henry, that they wouldn't want players' families coming. They'd be limiting it to the teams. And also, as I was just saying before we brought you on, that potentially if one player tests positive on a team, they might require the entire team to then be quarantined after that.
Yeah, it does seem as though it's at the government level where this has reached a holdup. I think, you know, how the government views how the bubble would work and function, and how the NHL views that is two different things. And I'm not sure if they're able to sort that out. You know, I think that's why the momentum has stopped here. And as best as I can understand, you know, I don't know for sure that the NHL was planning on having all of the staff workers that you know, work at the hotels or in the restaurants as part of their formal bubble setup. And I do think that could potentially be an issue there in BC with the local officials. And I think that's completely understandable. I mean, obviously your province and your city has done such a good job of managing what's gone on with the coronavirus over a number of months. You know, you have certainly for a city of the size, you know, probably the gold star in terms of the number of cases and the way that things have gone there. And so, you know, if you're making this decision at the government level, you have to do what's best for the citizens. And, you know, similarly, the league's in a position where its business is being severely impacted and, you know, has to really weigh the pros and cons of costs and everything associated with it. And, you know, it just seems as though without knowing or being privy to all the precise details that, you know, they've reached a point where there just might not be a solution that can satisfy both of those aims at this point in time to see Vancouver, you know, be part of the NHL restart.
And CJ, when this news first broke, there was some speculation that this might not even be just a Vancouver-specific issue or a BC-specific issue, but that it might be something that would affect the other Canadian cities in the running, Edmonton and Toronto as well. Do you have any more information on that, or has it become clear that this is only a snag that would affect Vancouver's chances?
As of right now, my information is that Edmonton and Toronto are still very much in this. I think actually, you know, Toronto came back in the last day or so with the revamped bubble situation, you know, that they previously submitted to the league. And, you know, I've been told it's been viewed quite positively and that there could be some traction for that bit. I think Edmonton's been viewed well all along, quite frankly. I mean, if it had a few more high-end hotels or larger, higher-end hotel, you know, might have been the front runner from the beginning. And so as far as I know, this isn't an issue that affects them. I mean, I think where some of the confusion, even for me, came in is that I thought that the issue with the cohort quarantine was settled essentially when the federal government came out and said, you know, this is something we'll support, that, you know, we don't mind allowing the NHL and NHL staff to forgo or bypass a 14-day quarantine as long as they're not interacting with the public and they're in a controlled setting. And you know, I think what I must have missed at the time, and I'm sure some others did, is that, you know, that was also subject to local approval and, you know, the comfort level of health authorities in each of those cities. And so, you know, as best as I can tell, it's propped up as an issue in Vancouver, but still doesn't seem to be at least an inhibiting factor for Edmonton or Toronto at this point in time.
And we've seen, you know, recently lots of reports of players testing positive in the NHL, as well as athletes in other sports and other competitions testing positive. Have those recent developments changed anything, either from the perspective of a potential hub city where maybe the cities now are saying, hold on, we have to be a little bit more stringent on our precautions? Or has it changed anything from the NHL's perspective where maybe they're considering stepping up their protocols a little bit, given that we have seen an increase in athletes testing positive for COVID-19?
Well, for me, the biggest impact it's had at the NHL level is just a reminder being sent to the players that, you know, you guys have a huge stake in whether this comes off or not. I mean, I would argue we're actually probably at the most delicate stage right now than we'll ever be. You know, once they get everyone into the system and get into a bubble, I think there's a way to create it where, you know, there's never going to be 100% risk-free situation, but I think you're going to have a pretty good understanding of the degree of spread and be able to keep things relatively safe. I mean, at this point in time, you know, we have players returning from Europe here in the next couple of days. There's a charter from Finland on Friday, one tomorrow that's bringing players back from Sweden to North America. I know a number of guys that have been spread around, you know, the continent here have started traveling back. I mean, we right now have a mass migration of NHL players returning to their playing cities. And in most of those cases, those players haven't been tested. And as soon as they either enter phase two protocol, you know, which we're in right now, the voluntary workouts with their team, you know, they get tested twice a week. Even if they wait till phase three, the start of training camp, you know, the testing could be daily or pretty close to daily in that circumstance. And so, you know, there's going to be a wave more of positive tests. I mean, I can't tell you how many, obviously, but, you know, I think it's fair to assume, you know, that the 11 we had last week that were announced on Friday by the league, you know, that was out of a pool of a little bit more than 200 players. Well, teams are going to be carrying 32-man rosters into this restart. And so for 24 teams, you know, that's going to be upwards of 770 players, give or take, that are going to be part of this. And so right now we have, you know, roughly 500 NHLers that aren't being tested on a regular basis. I think it's fair to assume that these positives are coming. And I think the league and the Players Association have been comfortable with that. You know, they've been in contact a lot with medical experts. I think this is something they were told to expect. But, you know, the one thing we don't know is how bad it will be and how the public will react, how the governments will react. And so, you know, I don't think at this point we can say with any certainty there's danger this won't happen, because 11 tests in the grand scheme of things, you know, isn't, I don't think, a huge warning light. It certainly was something that gets attention and I think should underline to the players, you know, how much caution they should be exhibiting, especially when they're not at the arena and with what they're doing in their day-to-day life. But, you know, we could reach a point, I think, as more players are coming back and starting to be tested, that, you know, you're getting such a concerning number of positive tests that it does make cities rethink things and, you know, might force the league to maybe abandon this plan or really change some of the protocols that they're anticipating having in place.
Chris Johnston of Sportsnet and Hockey Night in Canada with us here on Sportsnet 650. Is the league determined to go to Vegas at least right now, CJ? Because it seems like, you know, you look at Nevada in terms of the public health situation there, some of their cases have been rising here over the last week or so. But at the same time, you know, in terms of size of hotel and quality of accommodation, I would imagine that they're at the top of the list. And that's probably why it looks like they are going to be one of the hub cities, maybe regardless of what's happening with some of the COVID numbers.
Yeah, I don't think the numbers there have been enough to take them away from contender favorite status. I mean, you know, Vegas from very early in this process was identified as the most likely to be one of the hub cities. I think just honestly, the scope of the hotels they have there, I mean, there's almost nothing else like it in the world. I mean, those aren't hotels in a traditional setting. I mean, you've got, you know, controlled, you can have one building that has endless, you know, meeting space, you know, which teams need to have their meetings or even maybe for their meals. You've got, you know, 15 restaurants in a typical hotel in Vegas. You can give lots of different options to the players that are, you know, are going to be under pretty strict protocols, we would expect, by the time they get to a hub city. And I think that there's an ability and there's a willingness from the health authorities in Vegas and MGM, which controls a number of hotels along the strip and T-Mobile Arena, where the Golden Knights play, to make this work and to create a very, very, you know, a very controlled bubble, to have it as, be as tight maybe as any of the original 10 cities that were under consideration. I mean, frankly, that's more difficult in places like Vancouver or here in Toronto, where you have arenas, you know, in the middle of a downtown core of a city that's still got to function and, you know, a city that's still under various lockdowns. I mean, we still don't have very much going on here in Toronto because we've had a number of cases and the governments have been pretty cautious in reopening things. You know, it's difficult to create the same kind of bubble because obviously people are going about their lives here and, you know, certain things have to be protected. I mean, Vegas doesn't operate like a normal city, you know, especially that area around the strip where the arena is. You know, you don't have too many people living right there. I mean, it's geared towards tourism. It's geared towards big events. And, you know, I do think it still makes a lot of sense. So, you know, it's a fluid process, as I say, not the top. I'm scared to declare anything because it's amazing how quickly things seem to be shifting in this process. But, you know, Vegas has been at the top of the list, you know, right throughout. And you know, I've got no reason right now to believe, even with some of the outbreak they're experiencing in Clark County there, around that city, that you know, that's going to change between now and the Hub City announcement.
And we've heard some rumblings as well that as much as, you know, the players still haven't officially signed off on anything, that we could see guys opting out and choosing not to return to play. And I know you and Elliot have talked about, you know, there's at least one GM that has said that he's got a player that's telling him he's not going to come back and play. How realistic is it that we see a number of those cases where guys, whether it's personal health reasons, family health reasons, whatever it might be, choose not to come back and play if and when the postseason gets underway?
Well, I expect there'll be some. I mean, look, we've seen in the NBA, there's already been a few players that have opted out. You know, one, you know, because of a family situation with his son and doesn't want to risk that. I mean, I'm sure there's NHL players. I'm not aware of everyone's personal circumstances that, you know, must be contemplating something similar. Or, you know, we do know there's a few guys like Max Domi who have diabetes and potentially are, you know, could be at further risk if they were to contract coronavirus. I'm not saying Max has chosen to opt out, but I mean, he's got an underlying health condition that will make his choice a little bit different than, you know, your typical 24-year-old player that's deciding whether or not he wants to play. I mean, there's certainly some reservations out there. I don't think from the conversations I've had, I don't think it's going to be enough where we're going to see the players vote down the return to play package. I don't think, you know, that it's anywhere near 51% of NHL players that don't want to see the league resume at all. But, you know, even once that package, or if that package is confirmed by the players in a vote, you know, here in the next week or so, you know, I think that you know, it's certainly going to include some language that does permit players to not play if they have a reason that they don't feel that they want to do it. And you know, I think that we should all be, you know, when it comes to that point and if players make that decision, I think we should be understanding of those decisions. You know, this is more than just hockey. Obviously, I'm sure some fan bases, if they lose, you know, a player that's viewed as a valuable member of the team, might not be happy. But I think that they should understand that, you know, that wouldn't be an easy call to make. And so, you know, I think we will see. It's hard to even put a number on it, but at least a handful of guys opt out. You know, should the league find a way to restart and they get to the point where they have to make that decision. And you know, I don't envy them, but these are sort of uncertain times, unusual times. And, you know, it's going to call for a couple hard calls here for certain players.
CJ, we're anticipating the Hockey Hall of Fame announcement for this year coming up a little bit later this afternoon. Everyone expects that Jerome McGinley, slam dunk, open and shut case, that he will go in. I know it's hard to predict what the Hall of Fame committee will do in any given year, but what's your sense of other candidates that have a good chance of going in this year?
Well, I've got no idea what everyone's thinking on that 18-person board that makes the decisions. But what I love about this year is, you know, really Jerome McGinley from the male player category is the only slam dunk. I mean, Marian Hossa is another first-time eligible player. If he gets in, I won't call it an upset, but, you know, it's certainly not a sure thing heading into that conversation. And so, you know, I think that this is one of those years where there's an opportunity for the Hall to revisit, you know, players that have been passed by in the past and you know, change their decision on some of those guys. And so I wonder if we see an Alex McGillney get in. I'd like to see that. You know, I personally have the belief that Daniel Alfredson put together the kind of career that is worthy of him being in the Hall of Fame, but it's his fourth time eligible and he hasn't so far been able to do that. You know, those are the two names that for me that I'd like to see get put in, but you know, there's so much secrecy around this process that it's hard even predict with any certainty what's going to happen. You know, a player needs 14 votes of the 18. All of those 18 members of the Hall of Fame selection committee sign non-disclosure agreements. So they have to take to the death, I guess, you know, how those conversations go, who they vote for, how these things weigh out. And so, you know, when the announcement's made in an hour and a half's time, you know, I'll be as surprised as anyone else. But, you know, I think it's cool that there'll likely be at least a couple players that have had to wait a period of time to get this call. And then, of course, you know, Jerome Iginla, who, you know, I can't imagine that conversation took very long whenever they put his name on the table for a yes or no. I would hope he got 18 out of 18 votes, just because, you know, I don't think that there's many players of the generation that's just passed us that are more obvious to induct than him.
Well, and a name you bring up there that's interesting, CJ, before we let you go, is Daniel Alfredson, who, you know, in this city, we've been having the conversation around, you know, Daniel and Henrik Sedin. And while, you know, many people out here and many people across the hockey world would say, oh, yeah, those guys should be first ballot Hall of Famers, you could make an argument that Daniel Alfredson has a better statistical case than Daniel or Henrik Sedin do. Do you see the Twins as first ballot Hall of Famers when, you know, they get a chance to go in?
I think so. I mean, anyone who's led the league in scoring has won the Hart Trophy or the Lester B. Pearson at the time. I mean, those type of players almost always get into the Hall of Fame. And, you know, the whole case, I guess, where people sort of have differing opinions on Hall of Famers in general is the Hall of Very Good versus, you know, players that were among the absolute best. So I don't think, first of all, that Daniel Henrik Sedin, they cover both to me. I mean, they were good for such a long time, and they meant so much to that franchise. You know, one of the best teams of the last 10, 20 years was that Canucks, you know, their top level team. It meant so much to the community. They behaved as you would want the character aspect of a Hall of Famer too. And that is part of the mandate. I mean, when you look at the criteria that's evaluated, it's the way you've carried yourself too. It's not just pure statistics. And then I think that the statistics and those individual honors put it over the top. I think in both the cases, had the Senators, you know, managed to win the Stanley Cup back in 2007, with Alfredson as the captain, and had, you know, the Canucks, you know, won that game seven against Boston, I doubt we're even having this discussion for any of the three of those players myself. I mean, it's just amazing what goes into it. But, you know, had they been captains or leaders on teams that won cups, especially Canadian teams, and had the careers they already had, you know, outside of that, I don't think there would be too much debate. And so, you know, I think there will be a day when all three of those suites are in the Hall of Fame. I can't tell you for sure if it's going to be first ballot for the Sedins or if today's the day for Alfredson. But, you know, in my eyes, and you know, I was covering the league for most of the careers of those three, so, you know, I was able to witness it, you know, a little closer. I think that all three of those players will be Hall of Famers, you know, in their due course.
He is Chris Johnston of Sportsnet and Hockey Night in Canada. Thanks for the time today, CJ. Be well.
No problem, guys. Talk soon.